This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. Over more than 45 years of cruising with her husband Larry, Lynn Pardee has possibly logged more hours at sea than anyone else alive, and also probably done more to document those experiences in books, articles, and videotapes than any other. Pardee came all the way from her home in New Zealand to be at the 41st Port Townsend Wooden Boat Festival, where I interviewed her live during the four-hour remote broadcast from the festival of Phil Anders' Toss Salad on Friday afternoon. This week on The Compass, we bring you a lightly edited version of that live interview. So now, let's go inside The Compass. You know, you've come a long way.
All the way from New Zealand.
Did you come by boat?
No, unfortunately, I flew up this time.
But it wouldn't be unexpected for you to come by boat, because I looked you up in Wikipedia to get some background information, and, well, I wasn't terribly surprised because I know of your reputation, but Wikipedia says that you and your husband, Larry, are the best-known cruising couple in the world.
I don't know who put that there, but let's say that we have been voyaging and sharing our adventures for 47 years.
And doing it also in, shall we say, a kind of a sustainable manner and...
affordable, too.
And affordable. I mean, yeah. That's something you're famous for. As a matter of fact, you started cruising. I mean, your first... Was the Seraphim your first boat?
Well, it was the first boat that I cruised on. Larry'd been repairing and upgrading boats since he was 17 and did a lot of racing, but I came into his life about 9 years later. He was building a cruising boat for himself, and the two of us finished it together.
And that was the Seraphim.
That was the little Seraphim, 24-foot, 4-inch Seraphim.
Now, that's what many people would consider a pretty tiny boat for some of the things you... Why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the things you did in the Seraphim?
Well, we set off on little Seraphim to go away for 3 or 4 months and came home 11 years later after circumnavigating and exploring 70 different countries, working our way along the way. She was engine-free. We didn't even think about engines until the boat was at that stage of construction where we had to make a decision as to whether we spent the money on an engine or went cruising right away. Because an engine for the little boat would have cost us another year's work.
So I guess you had paddles.
No, we had a long oar, single oar that we used like the Chinese Yulao off the stern. But the boat was a fantastic light wind boat and maneuvered beautifully. So we basically set off right in the beginning to go away for 3 or 4 months and said, well, we'll go sailing, get a little bit out of our system, and then come back and work and earn an engine. But after 4 months, we were down in Mexico having a great old time, and someone offered us a chance to deliver their boat for them. And we earned enough in that 2 months delivery job to go off for another year. So we went sailing instead of going back and putting an engine in. And then we started to find that just the sheer pleasure of learning to, figuring out how to get in and out of places and sail the boat as she was, made us feel that an engine would have interfered with the fun we were having.
Was there ever a point where you said, actually, I really wish we had an engine right now?
Never once. But the big difference is, because the boat was our home, and you say it was small, we'd never considered it small, because remember, I was 24 when we set sail, Larry was 28. We owned the whole world. So the boat was our platform. It was not our end-all and be-all. She was really fun to sail. We both really like sailing. As much as we like going places, we like sailing. But we didn't live just inside that little 24-footer. We lived on deck. We lived in the countries we visited. She was our little cave, our turtle shell.
So when you arrived in a country, would you spend significant amounts of time like onshore exploring, or were you mostly boat-bound?
Oh, no, that was the fun part of it. Because she was small, we could always find a corner to tuck her into. and we could go off on other excursions. I mean, one of the craziest things we did, we bought a motorcycle. And we toured, when we were in Spain, in the Spanish islands, we bought a motorcycle, and we toured Europe for, 20,000 kilometers, I remember, we put on the motorcycle.
Wow.
And we had a tent, and we had a wine, two wine bottles, one for red, one for white. And it was so affordable to camp along the way, and we had a little rule, which was if we slept in our tent, we would buy a meal out. But if we went into a bed and breakfast or a pension, we would buy bread and pâtés and cheese and eat rough, as we called it. And, by having our little cruising boat with us, by keeping an eye on our expenses, but still allowing ourselves some real nice luxuries, we cruised for far below the poverty level, shall we say, amazingly affordable. And then we worked along the way, and we found that if we worked really hard for 3 months every year doing boat repairs and rigging and deliveries, we could have 9 months to play and do what we wanted to do.
So that would give you enough money to sail the world.
Yeah, we never worked more than 3 months because we said if we couldn't earn enough in 3 months, we either would be more careful with our spending or we'd work harder for the money.
So when you would leave the boat in some little hideaway place and go off like on your motorcycle, mm-hmm. How long would you be away from the boat?
The longest, when we were in Africa, we bought a four-wheel drive vehicle and we were away for 7.5 months.
Wow.
We lived in the Kalahari Desert with a pushman for quite a while.
My goodness.
But we were careful about where we chose to leave the boat. And
yeah, I was wondering whether you ever found the boat had been molested while you were away.
We had the opposite happen. I remember we had to deliver, we got a really good delivery job. We did the motorcycle tour, but came back and 2 days later got this really great delivery job. So we were gone for another 3 months. So altogether the boat was on its own for 7 months. But we hired a watchman to watch it. And we returned back after 7 months. And 4 days after we got home, this man who'd been caring for our boat comes over and starts scrubbing the boat down with salt water. And we said, Ollie, what are you doing here? He says, you're not taking good care of my boat. He says, you haven't washed it down for 4 days. So we never found the boat in worse condition than when we left it, usually as good or maybe a little, been cared for beautifully. Because we, instead of buying insurance, we always hired someone and paid them cash to take care of our boat for us. Not huge amounts of money, but that way they had a real responsibility.
I know that some people are kind of daunted, I'm among them, by the idea of setting off across the ocean where bad things can happen. Gales can blow up and, I've read too many stories of the sea to expect that I could ever. But then there are other dangers as well, like pirates. And in recent years, we've read more and more accounts of people being attacked, abducted, and things like that. Did you ever have any sort of experience? I mean, you must have been through bad storms, for example.
Well, if you want to hear about the storms, let's see. 3 cyclones, 1 hurricane, a cyclone and a typhoon. But I'm more afraid of the freeway than I am of being out at sea. They're a very favorite friends of ours who are no longer with us. Eric and Susan Hiscock, one day we were speaking to them because they were sort of mentors to us. They were people who were very famous in their day for cruising. Eric said to me, do you know, sometimes I find it hard to believe I live in the world I read about in the newspaper. And that's the experience we've had with our cruising, is that there's been places that we have avoided because we know they were disturbed. I mean, you look at the area around Socotra. When we came down the Red Sea, we sailed down the Red Sea back in the 80s, just after the Israeli wars. We were the second yacht to come through the Suez Canal after the 7-day war.
Oh, really?
And the ordinance was, we could not go towards various areas. They warned us and marked on our charts because there was a lot of unexploded ordnance still there. But we avoided the area around Socotra. We went 300 miles extra to stay well clear of an area where there was known piracy. We did not sail in the Sulu Sea. We went when we were in the Philippine area because we knew these were disturbed areas.
I see.
But we had the exact opposite. We had spectacular relations with people we met everywhere in the world. And the worst thing that happened to us as far as theft or piracy is we did have every piece of wine stolen off of our little 8-foot sailing tender when we left it and went to hiking in Mexico.
But the tender itself was
left. Everything was fine, but yeah. They cut all the pieces of rope off, and we figured it was a fisherman who really needed that rope more than we did. So that was the worst one that happened to us. But as far as storms, there's no way you're going to go to sea long-term, and as much as we did in delivering boats for people. I mean, we did over 200,000 miles of sailing individually. You're going to hit storms, but we had tactics that come from old sailing days that people use them now. In fact, we wrote a whole book just about the
yeah,
tactics.
I noticed that one of your books is about survival tactics, and I was going to ask about that. And actually, I was going to mention, in case people don't know, that, at some point, it seems like you really must have started making a living also from your writing, because you have written how many books now about your adventures? And advice books about,
13 or 14?
Yeah.
And, a lot.
And VHS tapes and DVDs, and, you have quite a sort of publishing enterprise going on.
It's grown. Right. I read an article in a magazine when we were about 2.5 years into our cruising, and I disagreed with it violently. This wealthy American had written an article that said that the perfect cruising yacht was this 51-foot boat that he owned. And the line that really got to me was sitting in the Panama Canal looking out at my little 24-foot sailboat, and his article said, "A few Spartan souls have been known to go in boats as small as 30 feet. Well, I looked out, and not only was 24-foot Seraphim out there, but there was a 17-footer that had just come over from England, and the biggest boat in the anchorage was 34 feet, but the average size was 28.6 feet, because I like numbers. I added it all up and divided it. So I wrote a nasty letter to the editor. And 3 weeks later, I got a telegram in the days when telegrams were big deals. And all telegram said was, "Prove it." And so Larry looked at me and he says, "Lynn, you put your foot in your mouth." He says, "Prove it." And so Larry and I sat down and created a survey. And we started surveying anybody we met who'd been cruising for more than 2 years. And I wrote an article called The Cruising Man Survey, based on interviewing 45 different people we met who'd been cruising.
And what did you find was the average length of craft?
At that time, it was 29'6". People who'd been out for 2 years or more at that time.
So under 30.
Under 30.
Yeah.
And that article, not only that, they bought the article. They gave me money for sending them pieces of paper, which I thought was quite magic.
Was that your first article?
Yeah, very first.
So that gave you an idea, I guess.
Well, and then the editor called us and said, "Tell me more about yourselves." And he invited us to come and stay with him for a week, during which we left with 19 assignments. Because he was so fascinated by the fact that we were out there cruising on a budget that he could imagine, but on a boat that he could imagine owning. And I don't think it hurt that the boat was really pretty in photographs. It was a very pretty little boat.
And it is. I've seen pictures.
Yeah, so. And so it led to a career, but we didn't. The writing money at first was fun money, and it wasn't until I've been writing for 7 or 8 years and had 3 books out that it was a substantial part of our income. But through the years, it grew, and I started doing seminars and lectures.
So are you the writer, or did Larry write as well?
Well, we used to joke that I told the stories and he told the truth. He did the very technical articles.
I see.
But we both worked together a lot on it, but I was the one who was the storyteller.
I see.
His boat building book, it's a textbook that's used throughout the schools in England that he wrote completely himself.
All right, so getting back to storytelling and storms.
Storms.
Yes, and storms and survival tactics. So, where did you learn your survival tactics?
Like I say, Larry was a professional sailor before I met him.
Oh, there's firing cannon off over here.
Oh. There we go. There's one more salute. I hope they're not firing at someone.
I hope they're not firing at us.
No, I think we're clear. We're well clear. Larry had been a professional sailor, moving big schooners around, sailed to, you know, film charters. So he had the chance to sail with some people who had tremendous experience. And he was taught about a tactic called heaving to that they had been used for centuries. It was used in the Bible. Even if you read the Bible carefully, you'll find that it was this, I forget which of the saints was caught in a storm in the Mediterranean. And if you read it carefully in the scriptures, it said, and he turned and faced God, and God calmed the seas around him. Well, what we're talking about is a tactic where you turn and face the storm and get the boat to ride comfortably through the storm.
So you think that the saint was actually facing heaving the storm.
To. Yes.
He was heaving to, and God... Yeah.
Calm the seas around
was, him. And was the storm, I see.
We can take this back. But now it's a technique that's been used by sailing ships for years, but right. We've found ways to adapt it to very small boats. Well, you're facing the wind right. and letting the boat create right. what's called a slick.
It's, right.
But we didn't want to, Larry and I were reluctant to write about our opinion of storm tactics, but then Captain Voss, a book that many people may have heard of, Captain Voss sailed dugout canoe around the world, Tillicum, right out of Vancouver, or right out of Victoria, and he wrote about it many times.
And why were you reluctant to write about it? Because you were fearing like liability or something?
No, because not at all. Because we weren't telling him anything. We wanted to tell people this is something that's been used, and people aren't talking about it anymore.
See.
But we felt that you know we're not the most experienced sailors in the world. Sure, we'd gone around the world in a little boat, and we'd gone around halfway again, but then at a certain point...
Arguably, that's a lot of experience.
It was. Then there was a storm off New Zealand, and when it was called the Queen's Birthday Storm. A whole bunch of yachts went on a rally between New Zealand up to Tonga, and they were caught in a winter storm. It was a pretty darn bad storm. And... many lives were lost, and many boats were abandoned. And we started researching it because New Zealand was our base by then. And somebody played us a recording. One of the boats was in this storm, and they were constantly calling into the radio, you know, the people who were keeping track of them. And they had been running before the storm for 2.5 days. They'd been knocked down several times. There were injuries on board. They were getting very tired. And the man on the radio said, I don't know what to do now. And the radio operator said, well, as I understand it, you could either keep running as you are or you could heave to. And the skipper of the boat said, I don't know how to heave to, so I don't have any other choice but to run on. And that's the last transmission.
Oh, dear.
And when we heard that, we felt we had no other choice than to put the information down that we knew it and hope that people understood these techniques and tried them out and put that into their arsenal so that no one else, you know, maybe someone else wouldn't say, I don't know how to do it.
So what are the basics of heaving to?
The basics of heaving to are learning how to get your boat to stop, face the wind, and hold its position so that the wind is shoving it slowly away from the wind. It's going slightly downwind, but still pointing towards the seas.
So you're facing into the seas
and into the wind. The seas.
And
at about 45 to 50
degrees. Is a routine part of that throwing out a sea anchor as well?
That's one thing you can do. When we were off, we came around Cape Horn a few years back. We beat around against the prevailing winds to complete a little game we were playing with
Tacking
ourselves.
All the while.
Yeah, and we wanted to be the smallest boat to have sailed contrary to the wind around all the great southern capes, carrying a nylon drifter at each cape. we entered. It was a little game we played, but it didn't. I mean, we encountered heavy weather, but we were in a storm.
And large seas in a small boat.
Oh yes, but they're beautiful seas. yeah, because there's down there you get huge spreads between the waves. 60-foot seas are not frightening because there's so much space between them. But we were caught for 2.5 days in 70 knots of wind and hove to, and because of the spacing of the seas, we didn't need any. We were able to use our storm trysail to hold the boat in position. And then the winds got worse and up to 85 and 90 knots. And at that time, we had to reef the storm trysail, but the boat lay beautifully. No damage sustained, except I broke 8 wine glasses.
Oh, dear.
The stem was cracked.
Was that but all the wine glasses?
Every single one in the locker, but not the ones in storage to replace them.
I did. There's not a lot of storage on a small boat like that, but at least you had wine glasses stored away.
Well, this was our big boat. This was our 29-footer.
Oh, okay.
But on the other hand, off the coast of Australia, when we were caught in what's called a squeeze zone between a stationary high and a tropical depression, mm-hmm. we had about 85 knots of wind, and the seas were only 12 to 15 feet high, but we needed a parachute storm anchor to hold us, to keep the boat held, so she was drifting slightly away from the wind. And that boat pushing through the water away from the wind actually creates what's called a slick. It's a disturbance in the seas that actually calms the breaking waves.
And really?
This is hard for people to understand, but this is what we want to show people.
It would seem like the slick would be behind you rather than in front of you.
Well, it's technically behind you, but right. It's in front of you because you're going away from it. Even though you're facing the wind, your boat is sliding away from the wind.
Oh, I see. So you're sliding backwards into the slick that you've just created.
Yeah, through the slick.
Right.
So it's a von Karman vortex streak, basically. It's quite complex to describe over the radio. Let's not talk about storms anymore.
We're not going to talk about storms because we have to get on to another thing that I noticed here as I looked through the Wikipedia page about your awards. You've won quite a few awards in your lifetime, including one that really fascinates. It's actually the first one listed here. It's the Mauritanian Legion of Honor as captain of the first American team to sail across the Sahara Desert in a land yacht. In 1967.
Well, that was
so
Larry.
So now that... Oh, that was Larry.
Well,
not you.
I was supposed to be on the team, but when we got to France to start the excursion, it was the last year that the French had a foreign legion in Algeria. And so the colonel there had become fascinated by land yachts, and he had this brilliant idea of sailing land yachts across the Sahara Desert. And when Larry heard about it, he said, "Lynn, let's do it." I said, "Larry, we're building a boat. We're broke kids. How are we going to do it?" Larry says, "We're selling everything we own, because how many times in your life do you get a chance to do something that has never been done before?" And I sold my piano to do it.
And yet you didn't go?
When we got to France and met with the organizers, they said they were sorry no women were allowed.
Oh, my gosh.
It was too harsh for women. Have an open.
I bet you took exception to that.
Didn't have much choice, but the thing is, they got me a job at working au pair for one of the wealthier families in Paris, and it was so much fun that I think it was. And Larry got dysentery, and I had a ball and learned a lot about French cooking, so it was a fair deal in the end.
Oh, well, see, I had all kinds of questions about land yacht sailing, but I guess we'll have to defer that. But now, I understand over the last couple of years, I mean, Larry has not been in good health, and so your sailing days with him are...
Yeah, Larry's... we sailed back to New Zealand in 2009, and Larry developed Parkinson's, and it became worse. And so we did quite a bit of sailing up until 3.5 years ago, when his abilities started to go downhill too far. But I've never met a man who was more content with his fate. I remember he was 75 almost, and when I said to him...
And how old are you, if I may be so bold?
I'm 73 right now. And I remember a year ago, Larry's, before the dementia got too extreme, I said to him, Monday. Don't you wish we were planning one more crazy adventure? Because we did a lot of wondrous, crazy things. And he looked at me and he said, Lynn, that would be downright greedy. So he was he's gracious right up to the end. And he's now in full-time care, and he doesn't recognize me. But because I know what he'd want and what I wanted, I've been invited to sail up to the islands again, so I'm heading offshore in about 4 months, do some more voyaging, because I do enjoy, really? I love being offshore. And that the thing I love more than anything in the whole world is when I'm 7 or 8 or 10 days away from land, and I look around and I realize that absolutely no one knows where I am. And even better, no one really cares. This is an unbelievable feeling.
So, are you sure nobody cares?
I don't, they're not thinking about me out there.
I guess your parents are gone.
Yeah, my parents are gone. They were wonderful. But, you know,
because they would have cared, I think, probably.
But they don't really. They just, you know, as long as I'm not causing them trouble, my parents are quite happy, I think. But no, I just like that feeling of...
How about when you were young? I mean, did you like concern for what your parents were thinking in any way stymie, or were your parents like encouraging for your adventures? Like, you know, yeah, go off in a tiny boat with no motor and sail around the world and be gone and out of contact for months. That must have sort of... would have driven my mother crazy, I know.
I ran away from home when I was 17.
Oh, you did? I see.
And my mother and I were, quote, estranged, although I used to send her letters until I was about 26 or 27. And then we became best friends. And my mother's whole attitude was, darn it, I wish I was doing that. She was quite a goer. And I don't think she ever worried about me when I was at sea. She worried more about me when we were living on land, because some of the crazy things we did on land worried her more.
Earlier, you and I were talking a little bit about young people who want to set out, and this seems like a really good sort of segue.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what advice would you have for a young person who dreamed of going to sea? I mean, like, should they wait until they get their resources together, or?
Never. The thing is, it's so easy to get out sailing first. People are looking for crew all the time. Get out there, get experience, get a little boat of any sort, learn how to sail it, and then start looking for that dream boat, because you can get a really good little secondhand boat, 24 to 30 feet, sometimes $10,000, $12,000, put another $5,000, $6,000 in it. You can go offshore. You can go places. Learn to use your own skills. Learn to fix everything on that boat. And all I can tell you is the most important thing that Larry's left behind is the motto that he created for the first book we wrote, Cruising in Seraphim. And his motto, go small, go simple, but go now.
With world-renowned cruising sailor Lynn Pardy, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Compass. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.